सतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतं गमय असतो मा सत्गमय तमसो मा ज्योति
Greetings. Welcome to our third class, Deep Practice for Radical Times. And as we start, I'd like to give a short homily, I guess that's the word for it. I wanted to say that one of the most relevant truths for us right now, and I don't think this is news to any of you, is that we are actually getting to see this very deep fact that we live in two worlds, meaning the outside world and the inside world. And in many parts of the world, certainly here in the United States, the outside world is basically a mess. But the inside world doesn't have to reflect that. Of course, the external situation works on us. It challenges us. It's difficult. Very difficult for some of us. But it also gives us an opportunity to really get why the state of the inner world is so important and why the work that we're doing now is, I think for many of us, particularly powerful, because in the general weirdness of life right now, it gives us a very strong motivation. Because no matter how hard the outside world is, we always have the choice to keep our inner world strong and clear and to center ourselves in it, even at times when the moment in front of us is difficult. And the fact is that even though most of you know how to do this, you've had training in how to do this, you've practiced to do this, but during a crisis, it's pretty easy to forget that we have this power. one of the deepest things that keeps coming to me again and again is how we just always have to make the inner world our priority. We can focus on what is eternal, what's not affected by change, whether we do it by taking refuge in non-dual presence, in mantra, in awareness of awareness, in a personal form of the divine, a form of Ishvara. And in fact, as we're going to see tonight, one of the main antidotes that Patanjali gives for acute mental suffering and even physical suffering is focus on one single reality. And from that place, we can recognize, we can begin to recognize, to actually have a felt experience that the self is not affected by external crisis. That experience may come and go, but we can discover, we can discern how to keep returning to it. You know, the late, great spiritual teacher Ram Dass, who was such a beacon to my generation of seekers, used to talk about how any situation, especially difficult ones, can be grist for the mill of our sadhana. In other words, we can use any situation to get closer to the self, to get closer to God. Even when we're under acute stress, the question can be, how do I use this situation to go to God? How do I use it for spiritual growth? And that's what the sutras that we're working with this week are really about. They're about recognizing, doing self-inquiry about the stuff that's in our way and what we can do to change it. So let's find ourselves in the posture of meditation. Settle yourself with the breath, inhaling down into the deep pelvic region, letting the breath anchor the base of our body to the seat, exhaling upward and allowing the torso to rise up through the ceiling. As the chest lifts and opens, as the shoulder blades release onto the back, as you follow the breath, the natural breath, the easeful breath, we'll take a moment to the community to find ourselves at the Holy Lake with its deep blue, utterly transparent waters, the Lake of the Enlightened Mind. We're all seated around it. And those of you who are drawn to do this can also imagine that friends, family members, children, your beloveds are all seated there with you. And as you connect your mind to the breath, as you connect your mind to the heart, sense the hearts of everyone here. Feel the connection between your heart and all of our hearts. And feel the presence of your teachers, your guides, the lineage masters who actually orchestrate this whole process that we call yoga. And imagine that you hold in your hands a candle, and with your magical right forefinger, ignite a flame and use it to light your candle. And then holding the candle in your cupped palms, create an intention for yourself for right now, for this moment, for this week. And place the candle in the lake. So we're here around the lake. Perhaps we're aware of the presence of these flames, each of them representing one of us and our intentions, sensing this carpet of flame floating in the lake. And now let the breath flow in and out of your heart with these thoughts. As you inhale, may our practice uplift me. As you exhale, may it carry me farther in my journey of enlightenment. as you inhale, may it enable me to be of help to others. As you exhale, may it bring joy. As you inhale, may all beings benefit from what we're doing here together. As you exhale, may our practice be of benefit to the earth herself. And because it's Earth Week and because this is the reality that we live in, let's just take a moment to offer our gratitude to this planet, to this extraordinary living organism who supports us, holds us, feeds us, nourishes us, receives our bodies at death. This planet of whom we are made, who is our mother, our support, our beloved. And with that awareness, let's invoke the two great powers of the universe under the names of Shiva and Shakti, and then we'll chant the traditional Patanjali invocation mantras. Starting with three Oms. Om. 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 Om Namah Shivaya Gurave Satchit Ananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sarike Sharanye Trayambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. Vande Gurunam Charanaravinde Sandarshita Swatma Sukhava Bodhe Nishreyase Jangalikaya Mane Samsara Hala Hala Moha Shantye Abahu Purushakaram Shankha Chakra Siddharinam Sahasra Shirasam Shvetam Pranamami Patanjalim Pranamami Patanjalim Pranamami Patanjalim. And focus once again on the breath. Inhale with the syllable hum as your diaphragm moves downward. And then as the inhalation flows in, allow the rest of the inhalation to move upward into the region of the heart. Not the physical heart, but the place where you feel emotions like joy and sorrow. Inhaling with the help of the diaphragm, let the inhalation allow your attention to take root in the heart, and then with the exhalation, let yourself feel the energy of the heart spreading through the whole chest region. One of the commentators on the Yoga Sutra says that the way we find the heart, meaning the heart as the spiritual center of the human body, is not by finding it anatomically, but by noticing the place within where we feel emotions like joy and sorrow. So it's really the feeling of the heart that helps us recognize the resting place that The whole classical yoga tradition offers us as the seat of deity, the seat of Ishvara. So let your sense of the heart space subtly deepen as the breath mingles with Hamsa, the inhalation of Hum flowing into the heart, the exhalation Sa, expanding the heart, feeling that the syllables themselves are infused with the energy of the divine. Feeling that the syllables Hamsa, which literally mean, I am that, I am the divine. Let yourself sense into this truth that these syllables are laden with this felt sense of Ishvara, with the subtle energy of the divine, so that these syllables are reminding you that your own heart is the heart of the divine, is the seat of the divine, and that with the breath and the mantra, you can activate that presence in your own heart. Feel that this vibration, this resonance created by the mantra and the breath, that resonance, that pulsation, that can begin to activate the energy in the heart, have the feeling that this resonance is the form of Ishvara, the particular sense of presence that the vast formless power of grace is taking within your body. Feel that the center of your chest is the velvety cave of the heart, the abode within which a human being can begin to feel the intimate relationship with Ishvara. You don't know how this feeling arises. You're not even thinking about it. Instead, you're feeling the energy of the heart cave, the resonance of the mantra and the breath. And we're going to use this felt sense of the heart resonance in the mantra as our anchor place during this class. And we'll be returning to it again and again as we talk about one of the gnarlier and, to me, most interesting topics that Patanjali addresses in different ways throughout this text, which is the obstacles, the obstructions, the glitches that arise for us as we begin the journey within. The intention here, at least as I understand what Patanjali is doing, the intention of describing these obstacles is to help us realize that the glitches that come up for us in our practice are normal. I mean, they may have their own personal flavor, as everything does, because each of us is a unique being, but they aren't really personal any more than suffering is really personal, even though it may show up in our own personal style. You know, when we don't see the universal nature of these obstacles, we tend to believe that we have unique weaknesses which might make us feel that we aren't cut out for spiritual practice, or that we have unique strengths which may make us feel that we are uniquely cut out for spiritual practice. But the truth is that every one of us is subject to the same, goes through the same stages and goes through the same issues. We go through them in different ways at different times in our sadhana, but we are all going to go through them. They're going to come up at every phase. That means that every one of us who's been on the path for a while, not just those of us who are beginning, but those of us who have been doing this for years, has been tossed aside maybe day before yesterday by one of these obstacles. So they are actually the residue or the symptoms or the effects of the very deep issues that we're going to be talking about later on in the course, those very basic tendencies that the text called the kleshas, the afflictions that arise out of primal ignorance. But these obstacles are part of what happens to us as we navigate the world from that place of ignorance and disconnection. So part of what these sutras, 32, help us do is actually show us what it will tend to bamboozle us in the day-to-day, and then give us a bunch of really effective antidotes that we can use over and over and over again. So here's the list. Disease, mental inertia, doubt, carelessness, sloth, inability to withdraw from sense cravings, clinging to misunderstanding, inability to reach the goal, and inability to retain the goal. All of these nine tendencies distract the mind. They are obstacles. And then the following sutra, Sutra 31, says, pain, mental agitation, unsteadiness of the organs and limbs, disturbances of the inhalation and exhalation, all arise with the obstacles. And Sutra 32, meditation on one single reality is the way to overcome these obstacles. Yay for that. And 33, an auspicious mind comes by embracing an attitude of friendliness towards the successful, compassion towards those who are suffering, joy in the virtues of the good, and non-judgmental towards those who do bad things. And there are some other antidotes as well, which we'll discuss as we go on. And both the obstructions and the antidotes, which we kind of need to study together, because the antidotes are really daily practices that we can use whenever we get tossed aside by the stuff that comes up. Now, I want to read you part of Pandit Rajmani's commentary on this verse and his take on the issues that normally impede our progress. So here's what he says. Some of us neither know nor care to know the spiritual dimension of life. Some of us want to know but lack the will. That's not us, neither of those. Some of us search for our spiritual core but fail to set our priorities properly. This could have been us at some time. Some of us, we start doing practice but don't drop habits that keep us stuck. We learn practices but doubt their effectiveness, so can't commit ourselves fully. We come up with all sorts of reasons not to practice or not to sit or to cut our practice short again and again. All these are obstacles. And specifically, I want to say too that if you've read spiritual literature in different mystical traditions, you'll find these same obstacles being cited in different texts from Sufism, from the great collection of the writings of the Desert Fathers, the early Christian monastic meditators. They're pretty much the same because they are deeply human. So number one is disease. In a way, we don't have to say too much more about disease, because if you know how, if you've ever tried to sit up for meditation when you're feeling really sick, you know how important physical health actually is for practice. Now, some of us have a large tolerance for physical weakness. I certainly do, and there's a lot of benefit in learning how to function through illness. You know, even if it takes lying in Shavasana to meditate when you have a bad flu. because at some point every one of us is going to face some kind of illness, and some of us have illnesses that we have to work with almost constantly. But what I always feel when, you know, I get the flu or a stomach ache is how much better off we are than the ancient yogis were when it comes to health. My guru's guru lived outside for months at a time, years at a time. Basically, he lived outside. He slept on the ground. He sat on rocks. And he had terrible arthritis, not to speak of other illnesses. Ramakrishna, the great saint of East India of the late 19th century, had chronic digestive issues. He had diarrhea all the time. But it never touched his ecstasy or his compassion. But on the other hand, you know, for those of us who aren't totally poised in that realized state, physical issues are a big deal. I mean, let's face it, as Tukaram, the great poet saint of Western India, who was so poor that he often couldn't feed his family, he used to say, first stomach, then God. And he may have meant, first you have to feed yourself, but I think he might have meant, first you have to take care of your digestion. Because if your internal organs are disturbed, it's very hard to do any form of practice. The reason why this is number one on the list of obstacles is not because being sick makes practice impossible, but because when we're sick, it's just much harder to feel clarity of mind. You know, obviously the body-mind connection is totally real. When your liver is disturbed, you're much likelier to feel be irritable. When you have a respiratory infection, it's much easier to get depressed. You know, so basic health practices like diet, exercise, and sleep are not incidental for yogis, and they're actually critical. And of course, those of you who've done hardcore yoga practice, especially those of you who've done hatha yoga with traditional teachers, might have ended up studying Ayurveda because it is the traditional system, as is Chinese medicine, that can that directly aims at healing imbalances in our body. And of course, Ayurveda and traditional Chinese medicine come out of cultures in which there is such a deep understanding of the way that the body and the mind work together and how they need to be kept in some sort of balance. But Ayurveda, as many of you know, describes three basic constitutional tendencies, which are called doshas, that are often relatively out of balance and which need to be attended to and kept in balance if we're going to experience that. The three doshas, kapha dosha is connected with the water element, and there's, you know, when you have high kapha, you often tend to be cold, have a lot of phlegm, slow metabolism, a tendency to gain weight, and you also can be quite a relaxed and restful person to be around because kapha goes with both inertia and with deep rest. Pitta dosha is highly active, fiery, prone to irritability and inflammation, but efficient and quick. And vata dosha is connected with air and wind, so like the air itself, it's mobile. Vata people tend to be distracted, scattered, and the food you eat and the activities you do can either help you balance the doshas or send them out of whack. Getting to know your Ayurvedic constitution or your basic constitution according to Chinese medicine or one of the other traditional systems actually starts to help you tap into the fundamental body wisdom that will let you know what's good for you at a certain moment, what you need to do when you feel yourself getting sick. And this is a hugely important part, not only of the wisdom that lets us navigate life, but definitely of the wisdom that lets us navigate meditation. So obviously when we don't know how to tune into our own bodies, we tend to look outside ourselves for healing, and especially these days to drugs and the latest popular cleanse or weight loss diet, which is not to say that there obviously are times when we need outside medical help, healing work, and drugs. You know, if you have bronchitis, it's very helpful to take an antibiotic. But we shouldn't let medical interventions become a substitute for our own self-cultivation. Because that ignorance, that primal ignorance that keeps us from trusting our intuitive wisdom about ourselves can also keep us from exploring the very real intuition that every one of us has about the causes of disease and healing in the body. So just being able to turn inward and ask your body what it needs right now will often change the way you eat and sleep and even help you kind of de-trigger yourself when you're irritated. So, you know, most of the time, pain, either physical pain or mental pain, is a signal that gives us information about what needs to change at this moment. So does your lower back hurt? Maybe that means you need to change your posture. Or maybe it means that the food you're eating is stressing your liver. Or maybe you're not moving enough. Or maybe there's a way that you're doing a posture, you know, an asana that is actually tweaking your SI joint. You know, so one of the really important things, obviously, that we can do now, which I hope you are all doing, is to just ask yourself, what do I need to do to stay healthy now? What medical advice should I pay attention to? What supplements should I take? I've used this coronavirus situation to really tweak my supplements, and I've learned a lot about what some of these antioxidant supplements can do for my general feeling of well-being. So in that way, this is a good opportunity. So the second obstruction, mental inertia, is often a symptom of the first. It's often the result, as we said earlier, of physical issues, but of course it can also be a chronic condition on its own. Basic brain fog is something that a lot of people have to work with virtually every day, and I know you know the feeling. You wake up feeling slightly off, somewhat depressed, maybe dissatisfied, or just numbed out and disengaged with yourself and disengaged from your life. It's that numb feeling, that disengaged feeling, that is really the hallmark of mental inertia. And, you know, when you sit for meditation in that state, it does feel very dull, very sleepy. And this becomes an obstacle when you give into it and let it go on day after day. It's one reason why asana and pranayama are so helpful before you sit for meditation, because they can help dispel mental fog. Mental fog, mental inertia, also can lead us toward the third level, which is doubt. And if you've read the Bhagavad Gita, you know that that doubt is considered one of the major obstructions in our spiritual journey. Now, doubting our practice, even doubting that we can make progress or that we have the capacity to make progress, is obviously problematic, and it's obviously in many cases a function of modern life, because our life in this world gives us lots of good reasons to be cynical, either about the world itself or about ourselves. And cynicism, I find, is a particularly spiky form of doubt, which can immediately derail our practice, because the cynical, doubting voice inside us, and we all have our own version, tells us that practice doesn't work, or it says, you know, oh, actually, I don't think I should meditate this way. Maybe I should do a different practice. Or, you know, my sister is studying with this teacher and she's having a fantastic time, and, you know, maybe I should stop this course and do that course. So this is doubt. And doubt obviously is really helpful when it leads to questioning of our own assumptions, and it also can give us a sharp intention not to accept what a teacher or the scriptures tell us if it doesn't connect with our own experience. A Buddha famously told his students, don't just take my word for this. Hold it up to your own experience before you take it as true, and that is really good advice. That's useful doubt. But doubt is also responsible for those thoughts like, these teachings don't really apply to me. I don't really need to meditate. I can just practice being the witness, or God is just a superstitious belief, or focusing on bliss is a form of spiritual bypassing, or do I really, really, really have this experience that I think I'm having, or is it something that I'm making up in my imagination? In the Philokalia, which is an early text of the Desert Fathers, they talk about a problem called the noonday demon. And the noonday demon, it's a state that they call asiddhi, which is a state of bored despair about your path, in which you doubt the entire enterprise of sadhana. And the Desert Fathers, who would wall themselves up for years at a time, in rather primitive, difficult conditions, would apparently, their biggest problem was how during the course of the day they would look out the window and they would say, why am I doing this? I never get anywhere. Why am I locked in here trying to find God? And in that despair, they would often just chuck the whole enterprise. So doubt can do that. The fourth obstacle is carelessness. And again, all of these obstacles are connected. So when you're not really accepting the teachings, or when you're lacking faith in the possibility that the teachings are really going to help you, that can be a source of doubt. But there's another aspect of it, which is that in order to really realize and to fully realize the truth contained in this teaching, we actually need to be fairly precise about how we do the practices. In other words, just as building your biceps demands stressing them over and over again, which can mean lifting successively heavier weights than you're used to, deepening your practice actually asks you to periodically take yourself a little bit past your limits. Because in order to build your muscle, whether it's a physical muscle or a meditative muscle, you actually need to keep overcoming resistance, challenging yourself a little bit more every day. And so being careful, vigilant, precise in practice is kind of demanding. And I know for myself, I have to remind myself about it every single day. And you may too. Some of us are super careful. Some of us have a natural tendency to be careless. If you're super careful, then your trap would be perfectionism or rigidity. If you tend to be careless, then carelessness is your trap, and it's good to know these things, because spiritual practice is about transforming the mind, so it has to be sustainable. It's a long-term process. In fact, in my experience, the art of sadhana is in many ways the art of adjusting and fine-tuning your practice to your state on any particular day. The Buddha very famously gave this advice to a traveling tambura or sitar player who was playing tuning his stringed instrument. He said, when you tune, it should be not too tight or the strings will break, but not too loose or you won't be able to get a sound. And this is, of course, what one of the antidotes to carelessness is, just being very vigilant and careful about, as it were, tightening the strings of your practice. So, there are different ways of being careless. Neglecting the practice, kind of doing it in a half-assed way, or it can come from when you're being actually quite rigorous on the mat, and then you forget about all the principles of practice once you go about your day, and then, and every one of us has done this. We eat, we have 4 scoops of ice cream, even though we know it's going to make us sluggish. We feed our mind with dark TV series, negative gossip. There are so many ways that we get careless about nourishing ourselves. And again, the opposite of carelessness is not perfectionism, it's vigilance. So, it's not that you should never eat ice cream or that you should never watch, Breaking Bad. It's just that you get very precise about calibrating when to relax and when to get tough with yourself. Which brings us to our fifth obstacle, Sloth, which really takes the edge off our practice. When we're feeling slothful, we procrastinate. Read one more chapter of the novel, we space out in front of TV, you know. And especially, we get lazy about catching the signals that come from the self. You know, I know people, and I've been one of those people, honestly, who, you know, gets this sense of, okay, I've been doing this practice for a while. I'm actually pretty good at it. I can get myself into a clear state fairly easily. So I'm just going to follow the advice of Ramana Maharshi and let myself just be as I am, recognizing that my true nature is awareness. And so I can be in that state anywhere. So we forget that relaxation is not really the same thing as laziness, because there's a subtle impulse, as you know, that will guide us every moment if we listen. That subtle impulse is not the same as the nagging voice of the inner critic. It's a much more subtle and kind voice, which might say, okay, you're getting all stressed out, barreling through your tasks, just stop and breathe. Or smell the fragrance of the breeze right now before you get in the car and start doing your errands or dialing one more number on your phone. It's that ability to notice the voice of the self, the voice of your sadhana, among all the other competing voices, that really helps you stay tuned to how the path is showing up for you at this moment. The voice of sloth actually overrides that. And, you know, if you look at your own experience, you might notice that there are times when you know something. As Carolyn Mace often says, you know, we get these intuitive hits and then we ignore them. This is laziness, a situation that one of my early teachers used to call laziness to the essence. That is, we can be very hardworking in everything we do, but when it comes to tuning into and hearing the guidance of the self, not so much. And this leads to the sixth obstacle, which is what the text calls the inability to withdraw the mind from sense cravings. And what they mean by sense cravings, of course, is unconscious binge eating. The sages didn't know about this one, but we do. Mindlessly scrolling through Facebook or Twitter, numbing out your anxiety by getting high every night, online shopping. You know, we all have our modern distractions. And as you know, every time you give into the spell of the cookie or, you know, the lure of the joint, you not only cement that particular samskara, that samskara of self-medication, deeper into your consciousness, but you also deepen the vasanas of the issues that you're trying to self-medicate around. You know, if you feel like you need to take a drink every time you feel anxious, you're actually deepening the anxiety because you're not working with it directly. So this amplifies your original confusion. You know, we all have the habit of looking outside for satisfaction, and that habit is not just supported by society. It's the very basis of our contemporary world. We're radically codependent on the world of form. And one way that you know this is true is that as spiritual seekers, we often feel validated, particularly validated when, you know, for instance, we read what neuroscientists tell us about the effect of meditation on the brain. Oh my God, they did an fMRI scan and they saw that, you know, this section of the brain connected to happiness and focus light up in people who've meditated for a long time. You know, and that's great. It's great to know that our practice has effects on our life in the outside world. But it's also a sign that on some level, we believe that the physical world is more real than the interior world. One of the issues with the inability to withdraw the mind from sense cravings, it's a very subtle addiction, which, you know, we could call spiritual shopping. In the spiritual group that I used to belong to, there would be this movement people would get inspired. They would hear a wonderful talk by the teacher. Then they would go into the bookstore and they would start buying spiritual jewelry, you know, a beautiful japa mala or a scented candle. And, you know, which is great. All these things are great. But they're not really a substitute for inner practice. So because in capitalist societies, we have this deep-seated belief that demonstrable material success is the true measure of our worth and value, we have this tendency to look outside for validation, for proof that we're actually spiritual people, and to sort of establish that validation by the stuff we have around us, or, you know, the fame of the teachers that we follow or the books that we read. And the more we do that, the more we become subtly cut off from our inner truth. And at this point, we might feel that we're failing, that we aren't making progress, that we aren't reaching our spiritual goals. And this is not the result of real failure, by the way. It's often the result of our addiction to measurables. You know, this is the seventh obstacle, believing that you're failing, or actually the text calls it failure to reach the spiritual goal. And a lot of our sense of failure comes from the fact that we're comparing ourselves to some kind of ideal state, and often because we have a habit of not feeling good enough, feeling that we're failing to measure up. When I was first meditating, I was in a group with a guy who was very much motivated by success markers. And he'd been pretty successful. He'd gone to an Ivy League school. He had a really prestigious job. And he would keep saying to me, you know, I'm so frustrated by meditation because I can't measure how I'm doing. You know, I'm used to getting grades. I'm used to getting promotions when I do well at something. But there's nobody here who can tell me how I'm doing. And I'm certainly not having any spectacular experiences. Now, you know, this is in the 70s. Nowadays, he could do biofeedback or get an fMRI, and that would tell him something. But it wouldn't necessarily help him discern how much he was being transformed by the practice, which demands a deeper kind of discernment. So the problem is, the reason that we'd feel like we're not reaching our goals is because we don't really understand what our goals should be. So we you know, hear about enlightenment or waking up, and there are a lot of people who talk about that with a great confidence and who tell us experiences that they've had of waking up. And if our experience doesn't match up to that, or if our experience is different, or if our experience is subtler, we often feel discouraged. So I know in my guru's world, because he himself had written a book about his own spiritual journey, which was filled with amazing visual experiences, totally extraordinary physical experience, visual journeys to higher worlds. And the people around him would often feel like complete failures because we weren't having that experience. So the real fruits of spiritual life are first the development of a quieter mind, the ability to turn attention back on itself, to connect to the underlying truth, to really tune into Shakti, to the Chitti Shakti, that's the true nature of the mind. And as we come into that connection, there may be powerful feelings of joy and visions and insight. There may also be really disturbing experiences of our samskaric backpack. And all of this is significant. You know, the visions, as it were, that we have of how totally screwed up our psychological state might be at a given moment is also part of the progress that we're making on the journey. Pema Chodron, who's one of my favorite Buddhist teachers, talks about how, you know, when we have a glimpse of how, you know, how crazy our mind is, or, you know, when we see the underlying depression that comes up sometimes and we feel really bad about it, she says, what you should realize is that this is something that is possible because of your prajna, because of the fact that as your mind gets subtler, you have an ability, a greater ability to discern what's in your way. And this is actually a sign of progress. Very often when we feel that we're not attaining a state, it's because we are subtly confused about what progress is. The final obstacle is a failure to hold on to a state. So I've often misinterpreted this sutra, this part of the sutra, as prompting me to hang on like, you know, like a monkey grabbing a branch to any experience of deep meditation that I have. But that is not actually what it means, aside from the fact that for most of us, that's impossible. What holding a state actually means is that we know how to return to a meditative absorption when it slips away, meaning that we're able to sit for meditation and at some point in the meditation touch into the self. And as we practice returning, that clarity of mind that we experience in meditation will eventually bleed into daily life. And the practices of letting go of thoughts and negative feelings and using breath and mantra, holding a connection to the self such that the witness within us can observe our ups and downs without getting completely furious at ourselves for not being perfect. All these are part of the process of sustaining connection to our inner being. So holding a state doesn't mean that you're always in samadhi. It means that you're willing to consider your whole life part of your sadhana. So let's return. You can find your posture. Notice how talking about the obstacles will often tend to plunge us into consideration of whatever obstacle is up for us at this point in our week. And begin to feel the breath very naturally flowing. The diaphragm helps draw the breath in. And then in the middle of the inhalation, we feel the breath rising into the heart. And with the exhalation, we feel the breath expanding the heart region, the heart center. And the breath flows in with hum, flows out with sa. And as the mantra flows into the heart and flows through the heart, we feel that this mantra, Hansa, is actually a form of Ishvara. It's a form of the self. It's holding the Shakti of our deepest truth. And every breath is offering that wisdom and that connection into the heart. See if you can, as you flow out of the silent state of meditation, see if you can just keep bringing your awareness back with the breath to the heart. In Sutra 31, Patanjali explains the signs, the signals that these obstructions are operating. The first one is pain. especially mental pain. In fact, there's a sutra later on in the text which says that the more we practice yoga, the more sensitive we become to even very subtle inner pain, mental pain. It's actually the line says that a yogi is as sensible is as sensitive as an eyeball. So slight feelings of being off actually are experienced as much more painful than they are when we're in a grosser state. So the Sanskrit word dukkha, as many of you know, which we translate as pain, actually refers to the creaking of a cart wheel. You know, it's, you know, when the wheels of a cart, or for that matter of a car, are out of alignment, it creates friction. I have this experience all the time with shopping carts. You know, I'll be going through the grocery store with my shopping cart, and one of the wheels will be out of alignment, and it, you know, the cart will stop and get stuck, and I'll have to pull it and push it. That's dukkha. So dukkha is in us. It's the organism's sign that there's something off, that there's something out of alignment. Physical pain can be the symptom of actual disease, but often it's also the sign that, you know, a sign that there's something off in your mental state. And mental pain, of course, can be affected by conditions in the body, but it's more often a response to the obstructions themselves. So there's a Buddhist saying, pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. Pain is part of being in the body. We're all going to feel it. We don't have to get tossed aside by it. And what that means is quite subtle. So in my experience, even physical pain can dissolve when you're very focused. I mean, for instance, right now I have an issue in my SI joint, which makes it hard to sit. But when I'm really in meditation, or right now when I'm teaching, I feel absolutely no pain, because focusing on something deeper, something wider, actually dissolves the pain in the body or makes the pain not noticeable. This is not to say that it's a good idea to go into samadhi and ignore the fact that, you know, that your knees are getting completely screwed up by your posture. This is not a good idea, but the truth is that suffering is avoidable when our intention is, when our experience is more inward. Mental discomfort can be very slight. It can take the form of nervousness or brain fog or just tension in the muscles. And where there's tension in the muscles, there's usually tension in the mind. So as many of you have shared, and this is, you know, a big deal in our practice, a natural response to mental pain is to try and get rid of it in any way possible. There's a lot of sharing on the listserv in this course and in many other courses about this very subject, because it is one of the biggest issues that we experience when we start going inside. And of course, the fact is that it's the very aversion that we feel to our mental pain that makes it worse, that makes us suffer it more. And that's why sometimes when we're trying to turn inside and do well with our practice and become better people, we end up, at least at certain points along the path, feeling like we're in a state of war with ourselves. You know, unsure that of what is true, discouraged by not being able to surmount the issue. And it's that lack of basic trust in ourselves that actually becomes an obstruction to the deeper healing that is happening under the surface. And one of the main signs that we're out of sorts or out of whack, the sutra says, is disturbance in the breathing. In other words, when the breath is choppy or short, or when we're wheezing or breathless or short of breath, these are often not symptoms of physical illness, though they can be, but the result of psychological unsteadiness and, you know, emotions arising that we're not processing. And this is why the breath, attention to the breath, is absolutely the first line intervention for nearly every form of stress reaction. So breath is a magical state changer for whatever level of discomfort we're feeling. Just paying attention to the breath. So right now, let's just take a second or two and return to the breath, sensing the breath pulled by the diaphragm, flowing downward towards the diaphragm with the inhalation. And then as the inhalation deepens, actually feeling the breath flowing upward into the heart, and then the exhalation flowing through the heart, through the front, the sides, the back. This practice of letting the inhalation move downward, of being conscious of the diaphragm in the early part of the inhalation, and then allowing it to naturally move upward, which actually mirrors what happens as we fill our lungs. In diaphragmatic breathing, we fill the bottom of the lungs, the middle of the lungs, and the top of the lungs in that order. So the instruction I'm giving you is a way of allowing that process to happen while focusing on the inner, on the experience of the inner body being moved by the breath. So allowing the breath to flow in, drawn by the diaphragm, and then to continue flowing inward as you allow the breath to open you to the energy in your heart. And then exhaling naturally a little bit longer than you inhale, because healthy breathing processes very much involve allowing the old air, the carbon dioxide, to leave your lungs. And this process of attention to the breath is one of the great antidotes to mental obstructions. The breathing practices for dissolving instructions include some of the more esoteric and elaborate forms of pranayama, which we will talk about a little bit later in the course, but not today. Because as many of you know, and this is definitely my experience, that just bringing your mind to the inhalation and exhalation will actually dissolve many, many mental obstructions and even physical obstructions just by itself. The practices that are called the antidotes are practices that I think many of us are drawn to. They are very much at the heart of classical yoga practice. Sutra 132, Book 1, Sutra 32, Sanskrit goes, Tat pratishte dartam eka tatva vabhyasaha. Eka tatva vabhasaha. Eka tatva vabhasaha. Eka tatva means one principle, one reality. Practice of concentration on one single reality, eka tatva, is the way to overcome these obstacles. Practice of concentration on one single reality, eka tatva, is the way to overcome these obstacles. So Ishvara Pranidhan, you see we keep coming back to it, Ishvara Pranidhan, and we will again and again. And this actually states the principle in even more, I would say, general form. Eka tatva can mean a very specific connection to a personal form of deity. It can mean the understanding of how you repeat your mantra. And it can also be a very wide non-dual awareness, a recognition that grace, divine presence, actually pervades your entire experience, and that you can take refuge in grace. You can take your seat in awareness of the presence of grace. So this sutra assumes, and I think correctly, that the reason we find our journey difficult at particular moments is because we don't trust grace. You know, there are many reasons why we don't trust grace. I won't say there are many reasons not to trust grace, because in my experience, grace is always trustworthy. It's always present. It's always there. And actually, our experiences of obstructions, the ones we mentioned and others, can serve as a kind of a dharma bell that can bring us back to remembering grace. But, you know, it's also helpful to look at why we don't trust grace, because it's very difficult to surrender, whether you're surrendering to God or surrendering to reality to surrendering to the kind of play of divine will as it's moving through your life. It's very hard to surrender to something you don't trust. And a lot of us who are trying to understand the spiritual technique, the spiritual practice of surrender, if we really look at why it's hard to grasp or hard to understand, at the heart of it is that we actually are not quite willing to trust that if we fall, grace will catch us. One reason for this, of course, is psychological, because our early childhood experiences might have really created issues in our ability to trust. Another is the extreme outward focus of modern society, which, you know, operates in a win-lose matrix that encourages us to define ourselves by how much money we have, by how good a job we have, by how smart we are, you know, and to distrust the flow of life because we're so afraid of failing, of falling off the ladder that we're desperately trying to stay present on. And since very few of us can be fully successful according to the measures of late capitalist society, we're often either blaming ourselves or looking around for something or someone else to blame, and this will tend to take our focus off the true source of help, which is the benevolent intention that underlies everything in this universe, and which is always ready to pick us up when we fall down. And of course, relying on grace demands that we also let go of our ideas about how we think grace should manifest. And of course, at a time like this, it's kind of hard to see benevolence in our current situation. You know, people are sick, the economy's crashing, and there are some very deep systemic issues present that are behind the crisis. So there are a lot of ways to look at what's going on now and get pretty upset about why this is happening. And it's also true that passive dependence on grace is not all by itself going to solve our problems. We do have to, you know, accompany reliance on grace with smart action. You know, there's a famous saying in India, there are two wings to the bird that flies to God. One is effort and the other is grace. Abhyasa Vairagya are really important. And if you think about Abhyasa Vairagya in terms of grace, you realize Abhyasa, effort, is what we do. Vairagya arises through being able to trust that which upholds us when we let go of what we think is upholding us. So as in that question, that statement that I spoke about earlier in the class, there is no situation that we can't use as a prompt, as a reason, as a way, as a method to get closer to the divine. And so the question always is, in any situation in our life, the question we can ask ourselves is, am I using this for spiritual growth? Am I finding a way to use this situation for spiritual growth? even when my personal ego is very upset with it, there's a way that I can use it to get closer to the underlying truth about myself. And what this might mean, of course, is seeing the deep anxieties and being willing to see them and then working with them when they come up to recognize them. So in this sutra, Patanjali wants to point us to how we cultivate our experience of grace. And essentially, his fundamental idea, his fundamental principle, is that the way of working with any and all obstructions that comes up rests on a firm conviction that there really is one truth underlying everything in our life and in the life of the world. Pandit Rajmani, in his commentary on this sutra, points out that grace is unconditional, that it's the very essence of this world, and that it's never out of reach. And this is certainly my experience, and I think it's the experience of many of you. So once we sense that, why are we reluctant to give ourselves up to grace? And it's obviously because there's so many moments when our samskaric patterns, our vasanas, are blocking our ability to see how grace is working in the situation. So we lose trust. And because these limiting beliefs are so familiar, we're so used to them, they're so much a part of our sense of self, and they're so mirrored by the groups we belong to, by the society at large, by what we see on the news, that we actually can have a hard time giving them up and jumping into the unknown, because that is what it sometimes feels like when we give up to grace and tune into the Eka Tattva, the one principle. And there's a lot that there is to say about the problems of modern and postmodern society, because we do absorb, we have absorbed basic materialism with our mother's milk, so to speak, and that's true even for people who grow up in very religious households or even very religious tribes, so to speak, because the view that permeates our society is the view that tells us over and over and over again that what is real is what we can see and touch, and that the invisible is not real and can't be relied on. So we tend to relegate, even if we're very, very spiritually pointed, we tend to relegate a lot of our understanding about what the divine is to the realm of myths and magic. And that means basically that we've been conditioned into a kind of a profound skepticism. And that takes many years to erode that basic materialist predisposition, which is one of the reasons why studying these texts, especially studying the non-dual texts, it's so important, such an important part of our sadhana. We really need an alternative to the messages that we get from the society around us. And actually, I think one of the reasons, or I don't think, I know that one of the reasons that the sutras that we worked with last week, sutras 23 and 29, want to guide us into contemplating personal deity is not because they want us to get stuck on the forms of the divine, but because they want to help us understand the presence and power of living divinity. And in the polytheistic religions like Hinduism, God is understood to have observable personal forms, which are called Shiva and Vishnu and Krishna and Durga and Lakshmi. But the sages and the underlying understanding of traditional Hindu philosophy is that one spirit underlies it all, that the forms arise and subside from spirit, and that the highest truth is without form, and yet the forms that we call, that the sutra calls Ishvara, are vortexes that actually contain the entire power of formless spirit. And this is such a wild idea, such an extraordinary idea, that it may take us years to accept intellectually, and that demands to be realized. But what Patanjali gives us as the, you know, the boat we can ride into that realization is the mantra. So in Sutta 29, Patanjali says that the syllable Om, which doesn't mean just Om itself, he's really referring to mantra, is the signifier of the divine, but that to meditate on it means to actually contemplate the meaning and significance of the sacred sounds of mantra. And that in Sutta 29, he says that from contemplation of Om, contemplate, which again we're broadening to mean contemplation of mantra, comes immersion in the experience of our inner being, the self. So we've been talking about mantra practice since last week, and I know that many of you are mantra yogis, as I am. And one of the most important things we looked at was something that I always keep returning to, because even after all these years, it just gives me such a radical sense of the importance of sacred sound. You know, so one of the things we looked at is that a real mantra, an awakened, empowered mantra, is a living entity in and of itself. In Kashmir Shaivism, in Tantra, in the metaphysical maps of the Tantra, mantras are considered to be living entities, like beings, subtle beings who exist in the highest regions of the invisible world, beyond Maya, just beneath the total state of omnipotent, omnipresent, utter bliss-filled power and awareness and love, Satchit Ananda, the total formless God realm, God state, not God realm. So the deity figures of Hindu mythology, Shiva, Krishna, Rama, Durga, Kali, have light bodies. They have an existence in light bodies which can be seen in meditation and dreams. Those of you who've done deity practice are familiar with this idea. And these are what we call the faces or the personal light forms of Ishwara. And by the way, you and I have personal light forms as well, which some of you have seen in meditation. But there's also an aspect of personal deity which is simply a feeling, a felt sense of presence, a feeling of love, a feeling of lightness, a feeling that everything is okay. And I call this, and you know, the tantras actually call it, the felt sense of Shakti. I had a really definitive moment about 25 years ago when, you know, as a person who comes from a typical Western humanistic skeptical background, I used to doubt that I had ever had an experience of God. And one day I sat in meditation and I prayed very intensely to be shown what God's presence looked like or felt like. And what arose was not a vision, not a voice, but a simple but very, very strong and palpable feeling of loving presence, an expansive sweetness that I could sense inside me, but which was clearly all around me, present in the atmosphere. And I recognized that feeling because I'd had it many times before, which I'd always called it Shakti or grace. And in that moment, I was being shown, and I've never forgotten it, that I already know God because I can feel the presence of grace when I tune into it. And that's true for every one of you. So God, Ishvara, is actually a feeling, is a presence. Doesn't mean that some of you may not have, you know, amazing visionary experiences. And it also doesn't take into account this other form of Ishvara, the sound body of Ishvara, which all deities, and the Absolute itself has a sound body, which is the great mantra, Om. Hamsa, which is actually a transformation of Om and leads back to Om, and also the other mantras, which are specific invocatory mantras that have to do with deity. These mantras are eternal, and when we really do mantra practice, our immersion in the mantra will eventually pull us through all the layers of samskaras until we land in immersion in the Absolute. It'll pull us through the veils of ignorance and give us moments of recognition of sacred reality. That once we've really committed ourselves to mantra practice, we'll allow mantra to be the touchstone for our entire practice. And that doesn't mean that mantra is the only correct focal point for concentration. There are other ways to tune into the divine. But mantra is a very palpable and very powerful way of doing that. One of the Shiva Sutras, the core text of Shaiva Tantra, says that the true nature of mantra is the light of consciousness itself. The true nature of mantra is the light of consciousness itself. In the tantras, when they talk about mantras being the light of consciousness, they are really not talking about made-up mantras. They're talking about these primordial mantras that have always existed in the cosmos, which are revealed from time to time to sages, and which become the mantras of the great lineages. So let's say Om Mani Padme Hum, which is very, very powerful awakened mantra, is connected to a particular Buddhist lineage. Om Namah Shivaya is connected to a particular Hindu lineage. They lead to the same place. They often have a different flavor, but they're all made of light and bliss. And in the tantric traditions, there are several keys to successful mantra practice, one being that the mantra should be one of those mantras. Another meaning that it should actually come from a lineage where mantras are cultivated and treated with reverence, and it should be practiced in the right way, which means that you should do it according to the instructions from your teacher. And, you know, in some traditions, a teacher will give you a different mantra for every stage of your practice, but that isn't always necessary, and it's not always even appropriate. Everything is on a kind of a case-by-case basis here. And often, when there is no guru in your life, or even when there is a guru, you can receive a mantra from within in meditation, just rising from the midst of your meditation, or, as happens for some people, in a dream or through the appearance of a sage or a guru who actually shows up in your meditation. More often, for most of us, those appearances happen in dreams, and will give you a mantra. And, you know, to receive a mantra in this way is not the same thing as deciding that you want to practice a particular mantra because you like the way it sounds. It's actually an initiatory experience, and you pretty much know that that's what's happening, even though you might doubt that it's real. And if you've had such an experience and you doubt that it's real, just send me an email and I'll let you know one way or the other. A mantra that comes in that way will often take over your mind, seize your attention. And when that happens, accept the gift. And finally, to really get the benefits of mantra, you need to do it. You need to do abhyasa with it. And that's when you really begin to experience the fruits. In the Kalarna, the Tantra mantra is defined as that which protects and liberates the one who repeats it. What does it protect us from? It protects us from the obstructions, any one of these obstructions. And it also protects us from the ultimate obstruction, which is the sense of duality. So we discuss this in the Q&A. Mantra is an incredible core practice for healthcare workers, for people who are on the front lines in situations like the one we're in now. And if you're doing something that's difficult or dangerous, have a strong connection with the mantra and keep it going. It's what's sometimes called a gold star practice. And these other practices that we're going to talk about in a minute, which come from Sutra 33, are also gold star practices. So before we tune into them, just let yourself bring your awareness to the breath. The inhalation flowing in with hum, touching the heart like an offering into the heart. And then flowing through the exhalation with sa, expanding the heart. Feel that the breath is bringing you into the center of your being, what's often called the cave of the heart, which I often imagine as a velvety inner room within my chest. And it might appear to you in different ways. For me, it feels like it's made of extremely soft, rose-colored or deep red light. And that center pulses. And when the mantra is opening up that center in the heart, when you actually feel the inhalation and exhalation flowing into and opening and expanding the heart cave, you can bring any question or any problem into that space, and the heart cave itself will reveal wisdom. So here is Sutra 133. This is a sutra that some of you may have learned in your teacher training because it's a really, really helpful instruction. Maitri karuna mudito pekshanam sukaduka punya apunya vishayanam bhavanastha chitta prasadanam. Chitta prasadana means blessed mind, auspicious mind. And the sutra says, an auspicious mind comes by embracing an attitude of friendliness towards those who are successful, compassion towards those who are suffering, joy in other people's virtues, and non-judgmental neutrality towards those who are doing bad things. Very good attitude to hold when we read these stories about the federal government hijacking the state's personal protective equipment. An auspicious mind, obviously, is a mind that can actually hold uplifting or enlightened thoughts, but the word prasada actually means blessing. So chitta prasadanam is a blessed mind. It's a mind that can not only hold on to blessing, but can even give blessing. And these practices, friendliness, compassion, unmotivated joy, and non-judgmentalness are actually ways of blessing both ourselves and the people in our lives, including the people we don't much like. So these qualities, these virtues, that's what they are, these perfections, are not really attributes of the ego, even a very purified ego. They are actually qualities that come from the self, which irradiate our mind when we pay attention to them. So, again, as someone who's been working with them for years, I can tell you that they really do take care of most of the issues that arise for us when we interface with their own imperfections and the imperfections of the world. So these are core mind-transforming attitudes that, for example, chip away at your inner Schadenfreude, you know, that tendency to rejoice in other people's suffering, the tendency to begrudge other people's success, that subtle emotional violence, the cruelty that we can manifest towards people who are not doing well, people who are suffering, including ourselves, and the envy that we experience when we see somebody who's really attained something, when we compare ourselves to others and wish we were more like them. And they're especially good for the self-righteousness, which seems to come up automatically in the face of perceived ethical faults, you know, and there's so much self-righteousness going on in the world right now, that the practice of neutrality is a really, really helpful practice for all of us. I think you know how a moment of aversion, how the impulse to cruelty, to envy, to self-righteousness can totally destroy your inner state. I remember early in my practice, I found myself falling into a state of utter, absolute love and joy, and it lasted for a couple of days. And at the end of the second day, I got a phone call from a friend of mine who told me basically that she was having an affair with my boyfriend. And my reaction was not so much personal emotional suffering. It was absolute self-righteousness that a friend of mine would do something like this. I mean, I was so filled with moralistic judgment about her. And I watched how that judgment just destroyed my state. Now, that is actually a fairly extreme example. It's hard to keep your equanimity when your friend has just told you they're carrying on with your beloved. But it could be much less intense than that. It could be, you know, could be seeing somebody who's not wearing a mask in the grocery store and getting overcome with anger or self-righteousness. And notice how it feels. So I'm just going to go through this list. This is our day for looking at obstructions and then practice the antidotes. Have you ever felt pissed off at someone who was really successful? Someone who's doing really well? And if you notice what happens when somebody else's success bothers you, usually it's because you have a feeling that they don't deserve it. That's the excuse we give ourselves for not being happy about someone else's success. And we really see this in our current cancel culture. you know, for instance, someone like the name that comes to mind is Kim Kardashian. You know, she makes a huge career out of a reality show, makes a lot of money, gets huge amounts of attention, and the world watches and can't wait to bring her down. So they make fun of her, you know, and every time she does something silly, there's a Twitter storm critiquing her, and people cancel her, as it were. So, and this, of course, doesn't just happen in celebrity culture. I have an old friend who's extremely talented, charismatic, and ambitious, and she's always rising to anything she gets involved with. She kind of becomes, she rises to the top. And all her life, she's had rivals, people who feel that because she takes up a lot of space in their world, that she's a threat to their position. And this actually is kind of an issue for women, because in many situations, there's not room for, you know, many organizations, for instance, there's not as much room for women as there is for men. So women are, you know, often competing for the one slot or the two slots. So there's a lot of rivalry, but it happens to guys too, of course. So for years, I've had, you know, other friends calling me up to badmouth her. And it's always about how she doesn't deserve the good luck she has. Several times over the years, people have found a way to use her personal eccentricities or a mistake she's made to, you know, kind of take her out of a position in which she was actually very successful. And one of the things that I started to realize as I looked at her, I started to look at myself and how there is often this, you know, subtle kind of tendency to critique somebody who's doing really well, whether we're because we're competitive with them or resent it, or maybe we're just hypercritical. But that antagonism, that resentment of successful people, which is usually the result of a frustrated desire to have what they have or something comparable, is actually a really obviously destructive emotion to hold in ourselves. And it can also be quite hurtful to the people we direct it towards, because, you know, our inner feelings are not necessarily just held inside. They're felt by the people around us. So practicing friendliness, actually training ourselves to take a positive attitude towards people who are doing well in the world, even the people who we think are kind of silly or whom we suspect don't deserve it, the process that you go through to cultivate friendliness towards the happy, towards the successful, is first of all to realize that they do deserve it. Simply because the law of karma really does determine our position in life, and highly successful people have either worked hard in this life or they've accumulated some merit in their previous lives to have the opportunities that they have in this one. And this is true even of the people that we think that we would really prefer to not hold the positions that they hold. One way or another, they deserve it, even if they seem to be lacking in admirable qualities. One of the strategies that I use to cultivate friendliness is to remind myself of all the talents and gifts that this person might have, of their hard work, and also of the fact that I just have no idea what good things they did in the past that is allowing them to have such a great life now. But the other thing that I often do is remind myself of how bad I feel when I critique others. And so that great Buddhist mantra, may they be happy, may this person be happy, may they be healthy, may they be free, may they be blessed, may they be happy, may they be healthy, may they be free, may they be blessed. That's the mantra for cultivating maitri, the feeling of friendliness, towards anyone. And it's incredibly, as you know, it's very, very good for opening your heart. So right now, think of someone that you feel critical of, and it can be a public figure for sure, or it could be someone that's there in your personal life, somebody who is doing well, but whom you have a sort of nagging, niggling feeling really doesn't deserve it. So is there something about them that you secretly envy? Is there a nugget of resentment that keeps you from thinking generously about them? See if you can notice that feeling. It's not a pleasant feeling. And now antidote it by imagining that person feeling joyful. Not just sending them a blessing, but actually visualizing them and visualizing them in a state of extreme happiness. Feel that happiness and satisfaction spreads out from their heart. And notice how when you picture this other person feeling happy, that it also impacts your heart. So imagine their joy and then take it in yourself and send it back to them. The second quality that antidotes a darkened mind is karuna, compassion. Karuna is the antidote to hardness of heart, to cruelty. And all of us have some cruelty in us. It is actually part of the structure of the human being. You know, maybe it comes from our chimp ancestors, as some people say. But even if you're a very nice person, very even person, chances are that there's someone in your life, maybe your partner or your kid or a family member, who triggers irritability in you from time to time, because these intimate relationships are often the real arenas for the play of interpersonal cruelty. And it can take the form of harsh words or thoughts or other forms of behavior that hurt somebody. And of course, from that interpersonal cruelty, there's the larger form of cruelty or harshness which has run through the world ever since it began, which is basic cruelty towards the poor and the marginalized. And, you know, we see so many examples of it in this world. It's so heartbreaking. And it's heartbreaking also to look at ourselves and to see how we tend to dismiss people who are suffering or who are struggling. Partly because we're afraid that if we look too much at suffering, it's going to trigger our own suffering. And because we find our own pain unacceptable, because we want to get rid of our own pain, we will often create an inner climate of anger, shame, fear that we directed ourselves and then project that onto others. And that's one reason why so much of the time we fail to be present and helpful to other people. So on one level, learning compassion for others might start with consciously offering help to somebody or to others, you know, or going out of our way to recognize and support someone or a group of people who are suffering. And it's important to recognize that real compassion, the kind that changes your heart, is not an emotion. It's actually a quality of the self. And I think many of you, I certainly do, know that there is the practice of compassion, which is rich and beautiful and complex, and then there's the arising of compassion, which can be the result of practice, but which is actually a form of godness. You know, it's the self, it's the divine that really feels compassion. And of course, what compassion also includes is having compassion for yourself, for your own feelings of unworthiness, for your shame, for your irritability, for your failures. And, you know, even for those moments when your own suffering makes you less than kind to other people. So, you know, compassion, as many, many teachers have said, is not the same thing as pity. And it's not even the same as sympathy or empathy. And it's certainly not the same thing as valorizing people whom we designate as victims. One of the things about pity is that it often includes a feeling of, thank God that it isn't me. Pity for ourselves, at least in my experience, often grows out of a feeling helpless or feeling weak. Self-pity, including pity for others, actually impedes our ability to give real help either to ourselves or other people. But practicing compassion is actually about meeting suffering, meeting our own suffering, meeting the suffering of others, not by trying to fix it, but by actually being willing to be present with it, to sit with it, without trying to fix it or make it go away. And I think, as most of you know, we do need to start with ourselves, which is really, really hard. It can be easier to express compassion for somebody else than to really hold compassion for yourself. But to the extent that you can tune into a suffering state or a contracted state and simply let it be there with a feeling of kind attention, you're kindling compassion. You're practicing compassion. You know, one of the questions that comes up, that came up this week on the listserv and came up today in a lot of the posts, is a question about how you tell the difference between genuinely letting go and suppressing or pushing away feelings. And the answer that someone gave and that I would give is that real letting go starts with accepting the presence of what it is that you want to let go of. Meaning everything from a naggy thought to a deep feeling of unease. You know, there's that law of consciousness that we've often heard expressed as what you resist persists. And another way of saying that is that you can't let go of something when you're actively trying to push it away. In other words, aversion is not just the opposite of attachment, it's actually the other face of attachment, and it's just as sticky. In fact, your aversion to your own suffering can be even more sticky than your attachment to it. And one of the reasons that it's so hard to be compassionate towards ourselves is because we unconsciously believe that if we let ourselves feel something that hurts, we'll be stuck in it, or it'll overwhelm us. And, you know, what that often means is that when we see our own pain or when we see someone else in pain, we want to stay away. You know, we don't want to visit a sick person in the hospital even when we can, because to see someone who's suffering reminds us that we could be suffering. And if we don't know how to fix it, it can be really hard. So for many of us, the opening into compassion comes when we can allow ourselves just to sit with somebody who's upset and just be there. Just be able to say, okay, this is what's happening. This is how it is right now. I'm not going to pretend it doesn't hurt. I'm going to acknowledge my helplessness. I'm going to feel the woundedness. It is what it is. And there's some kind of magic in that self-acceptance, in that acceptance of another's suffering, because that, there's a natural letting go that happens as soon as you have that feeling, because that's when you can feel the presence of grace, which is always there underneath the disturbance, underneath the suffering, and which is always ready to embrace and dissolve it. There's a beautiful story that Tara Brach, I believe it's Tara Brach, tells it about a colleague of hers, a Buddhist teacher, who had early stage Alzheimer's, but was still cognitively functional enough to keep teaching. And one day he was leading a class when all of a sudden, in the middle of his talk, his mind went blank. So the people watching saw this look of utter panic crossing his face. And he was absolutely silent for about a minute. And then he began to speak, speaking from out of the practice that he'd been doing, the mindfulness practice he'd been doing, reporting on what was happening. So he would say, blankness is present. Now fear is arising. Okay, panic is arising. Blankness is present. Depression, sadness is coming up. And he just went on reporting what was coming up in his mind until he was able to say, equanimity is arising. Acceptance is arising. It was an incredible moment for everyone present, not only of realizing the power of mindfulness practice, but seeing that just being present with yourself when something horrible is happening is enough in that moment to heal it. And what happened in that moment, as you can imagine, was that this radical feeling of compassion just filled the room. So again, for just a moment, if you can, consider something about yourself that you really don't like. You might not be feeling into it at the moment, and you know, basically I hope you're not, but at least you can bring it present. And just have the feeling of letting it be there. Essentially, saying to yourself, I accept this truth that I'm not as smart as I'd like to be. That's one of mine. I accept the fact that this person whom I wish was more loving is not going to be more loving. And I accept the feeling that I don't deserve love that comes up when I don't feel her love. I let this be there. I let myself be with it. It's okay. It is what it is. And just for a moment, see if that intention to accept what in other moods you would find unacceptable, see if that intention to accept opens a kind of door in your heart, allows a kind of relaxation. And perhaps you can feel the compassion of simply accepting your humanness. Simply accepting the fact that every one of us is imperfect. That every one of us has qualities and experiences that we'd rather not have. And that the love, the grace behind all this is actually the deeper truth that can hold this. Just let yourself feel that, know that. And if what's coming up is resistance, accept that. Let that be. The third positive feeling that we cultivate is mudita, which means sympathetic joy in other people's good qualities, in other people's spiritual attainment. Sometimes when we don't feel that we ourselves have fully opened to our own spiritual qualities or haven't fully realized our potential good qualities, we look at somebody who has, you know, somebody who's having great spiritual experiences, which is a, you know, kind of a common example, and we feel jealous of them, we feel envious of them, we compare ourselves to them and we feel bad. There is something for human beings about some other people's virtues, other people's spiritual expansion that we can look at as an implicit critique of our own lacks. And that's when we feel envy or jealousy. One of my friends, who's a spiritual teacher, often says that when you feel jealous of somebody else in this particular way, it's often pointing to the attainment or the quality that you are meant to express yourself. So one way of dealing with envy is to say, okay, I envy this person, you know, because they're so kind. So rather than envying them, let me bring forth my own ability to be kind. You know, so that's one way to work with envy. But what the text is saying is that if we can just feel happy for that person, oh my God, how great it is that, you know, she's dancing in ecstasy in her meditation room every day, or that she's so able to be empathic and present with the people around her, that she's so good at relationships. Be happy if you can let yourself direct joy and happiness towards that person, rather than feeling like it's showing up your own lacks. Then another person's good qualities can be felt inside you as though they were your own, which of course they are, because the truth is that we're not different from each other. Thinking about somebody else's goodness is really good for the mind. And in these last few moments before we do our final meditation, I want to point you towards the quality of neutrality that we need to cultivate as an antidote to self-righteousness. As I said earlier, self-righteousness is one of the big diseases of modern times, and you know, if you see somebody cutting in line at the movie theater or at a restaurant, or you know, just going up to the counter at a bar and ordering a drink when there's four people ahead of you in line, you know, all the things that we see people doing, not wearing a mask in the grocery store. And you feel so self-righteous. How can they do that? I would never do that. You just fill yourself with moral outrage. Or you see somebody scolding their child and you say, I would never do that. That person's such a bad parent. And it's interesting that when somebody behaves in ways that are unethical or immoral or cruel or just really bad, the antidote is not making excuses for them. It's not loving them anyway. It's just being neutral. It's just maintaining some mental equanimity. Okay, that's how that person is. That's how that person is acting. If there is no reason to intervene, sometimes there is a reason to intervene, no question. You can intervene in a way that is equanimous. You know, it's one of the reasons that we're often told not to tell somebody what they've done that hurt your feelings when you're in the middle of your experience of hurt feelings. It's better to wait until the charge has died down a bit so that you can talk to them from a neutral place. So, those are the sutra doesn't say that you shouldn't act to make a bad situation better. You shouldn't try to correct what is wrong, to correct injustice. It just says that you shouldn't act out of anger and judgment or self-righteousness or a feeling of moral superiority. Or at least when you catch that in yourself, you should notice it and see if you can move into a position of neutrality about it. There are a lot of situations around these days that can make us feel extremely self-righteous. And I think all of you know, as I do, that if you let yourself get into it, you can be in a state of, you know, anger 5 or 6 hours a day. So rather than confusing the impulse to right wrongs or to correct injustice with the self-righteous feeling of anger about it, don't get confused into thinking that self-righteousness is going to help anybody. The feeling of self-righteousness gets projected onto the people that we're talking to, and they feel it, and then they just want to resist any attempt that you make to change them. So take a moment right now and look at the situations you see around you that might arouse your righteous anger. And ask yourself, to what degree am I using this feeling of righteousness to feel superior, to feel better than other people, to deflect my attention from my own suspicions about flaws I might have, or to express solidarity with my own tribe? And especially ask yourself, how does this feeling of self-righteousness feel in my own body? See if you can notice the subtle or not so subtle disturbance that self-righteous anger gives you. The way I work with self-righteousness often, when I start feeling it, is I expand my awareness so that there's a kind of space around the prickly, angry feeling of moral superiority. And I just hold those two things together. And I let the felt sense of self-righteousness kind of morph. Not trying to excuse the other person's behavior or the situation, but just letting myself get into a neutral place about it. And very often from that neutral place, a solution can present itself or an effective action. Or I can just walk away and not create any more karma by running up to them and saying, God damn it, if you're not wearing a mask, you could be making me sick, which I've seen people doing in my local grocery store, and which I've sometimes had the impulse to do myself. Sympathetic joy for the virtuous, neutrality towards those who are behaving badly, friendliness towards the successful, compassion towards the suffering. Directed at the people in your life and directed at yourself. These are antidotes to many of the feelings that disturb our equanimity and basically make us crazy. And we'll be practicing this week. So right now, in these last couple of minutes that we're going to be together, take refuge in the practice that Sutra 34 gives us, which is paying attention to the breath. And allow yourself to inhale and exhale with awareness of the mantra flowing into your heart as an offering into presence, and allowing your heart to expand with the exhalation. The breath anchors you to the inner heart, dispels obstructions, brings Shakti into your body, allows you to let go of contraction. The breath and the mantra together fill you with the bliss of Ishwara, the bliss of Shakti, the bliss of the life force herself. If you can, sit for a while and let the breath flow in and out through the heart. This brings our class to an end. This talk will be available tomorrow, and I really suggest you listen to it another time. So much love to each of you. I offer friendship, compassion, sympathetic joy to each one of you, and join you in holding a space of neutrality and pure awareness that can allow us to be aware of everything that might be obstructive in this world, without allowing our anger or our hurt to destroy the peace of the heart. May we live in grace now and all through the week. Namaste.
Asato ma satgamaya tamaso.